Housekeeping. Okay, so for those of you who have not been paying attention for the day, there is a wine and cheese reception after this talk in room 214. If you still have not signed up for the Diner on Ottawa, it may be full. I don't know. Check with the reception desk. This talk is co-presented by Chris Romeo, who is a founder of a company called Security Journey. And Asha Farah, also a founder of a company called Acumen Security. And I believe they both used to be co-workers at a company we shall remain nameless. So please welcome Asha and Chris, who are going to present how to build a product security program with SDL and certifications.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we need two mics.
Yeah, we need two.
Oh, you
yeah,
want
yeah.
Them?
Yeah, please. All right, that's not working at the moment, so you're going to have to move that forward. No, no, it's okay. Okay, so hey, thank you for sticking around here towards the end of the day. My name is Chris Romeo, and I am the CEO of Security Journey. I did actually escape from the world of FIPS for some number of years, but I now just realized I'm back at the conference, so I guess I really never did. Back when I was working on FIPS, FIPS 140-3 was about to come out. So I don't know that that didn't come out yet, right?
Not yet.
Okay, not yet. Maybe soon. But yeah, so Ashton and I did work together at Cisco. We both ran Cisco's global certification team at different times. And so a lot of what we're going to share today comes from our shared experiences in doing that. So
Ashton Vora, co-founder and lab director for Acumen Security. Been doing FIPS for about 13 years now, too long. I haven't been able to escape yet, got deeper in, but clearly I enjoy it. And as Chris mentioned, we were co-workers at Cisco, we held the same roles at different times, and we're trying to bring what I saw from a product vendor and a lab perspective, and what he saw from a product vendor and now as a consulting to companies of how to build secure development life cycles, how we can get efficiencies for certification within your SDL program.
All right, so here's our basic breakdown of what we're going to talk about. So we've got a couple of items on the problem space here, a little bit about, you know, what do we see with the world of vulnerabilities right now and, you know, certification challenges that we might have. Then we're going to talk about this idea of a product security program. What are the pieces that go into that? How do you build one of these things up? And then we'll talk about how certifications can fit into that, and then we've got a couple of tips for folks to help with from a collaboration perspective across that. So you know, security vulnerabilities, they do just continue to rise. There's no, you know, we continue to have more new security vulnerabilities come out. We've come to the point now where security vulnerabilities have their own marketing program. Right, Heartbleed, Bashbug, Poodle, Drown. You know, every one of these. What was the latest one that just came out that was a flop?
Logjam.
Yeah, that was the one that just came out. Now that was a flop, but they had a good website. So, but the point is that this isn't going to change, and those vulnerabilities aren't even the biggest things that we have to worry about from a, you know, product security perspective. Those are the ones that everybody knows a lot about, but there are, you know, hundreds of vulnerabilities that exist in the products today that are even more important to take a look at.
So as vulnerabilities are going up, as our certification requirements, you know, what used to be, you know, do FIPS and you're done with it, now you do FIPS, COM criteria, UCAPL, country-specific standard certifications, and then vertical-specific certifications. And budgets are not going up. We have, you know, security field is great, but individual budgets, I've seen internally when I was at Cisco, and overall, the budgets are not going up. So you have been asked to do more with less.
So I thought I would just share a couple of statistics that I found. I actually got these from Veracode's State of Software Security. They put out a kind of an interesting quarterly update on application security. But look at that number there. 3 out of 4 applications produced by software vendors fail OWASP Top 10 when first assessed. 63% of internally developed web apps are out of compliance with OWASP Top 10 when first assessed. So I mean, the point here is that we have, you know, we have big problems that exist in applications. And the good news is there's actually something we can do to fix it. There is a, you know, we can put together a program that is focused on how do we address these vulnerabilities early in the process, early in the life cycle.
And there's a fascinating talk by, he called himself, I guess, you know, NSA's hacker in chief. I would recommend strongly to go see this talk. He did it about 3 or 4 months back. And he basically said that if you guys think we burn 0 days on every hacks we do, you guys are nuts. Most of the intrusions that we do are because of misconfigurations and basic items that people are not doing right. This proves it. 3 out of 4 vulnerabilities are from OWASP software. That should be simple to fix.
Yeah. Okay. So. This chart is kind of a new take on some old research that was done. I believe it goes back to IBM in the 70s. They did this kind of study of how much does it cost to actually fix a vulnerability in the different stages. And I actually found this recently in a NIST director's report or something. They brought this idea back out. But the big idea here is as you go across the top with those different life cycle points in the life of your product, it gets more and more expensive to fix a vulnerability or even a bug as it comes out. So, you know, if you find that bug as a design problem early on, you know, in your requirements phase, it's relatively easy to fix. But if you wait until you find it in test, it's going to cost you 10 times more effort to do that. And then if you wait until release, well, it's 30 times more. And so I think, you know, usually everybody can agree, yeah, that kind of makes sense. We want to try and fix our problems back here, maybe even in the coding phase, but definitely not after these problems get out to our customers. And the certification process can be hampered by that even more because, right, I didn't even put certification, right? I mean, for FIPS, you got to have a released version of code or very nearly a released version of code. So if we add that other, I don't know what the bubble size would be if we went out to after it was released and it was had to go back all the way to the start or, you know, from a revalidation perspective.
Now on those lines, right, let's talk about some certification pain points, bolted on versus baked in. A lot of times, certification requires a bolted on. The product is out there, you've been selling it, and now you decide, okay, you have to do certification. So now you have to go back, add, if you're doing, for example, NDCPP, you're changing the fundamental plumbing of your product. You're changing authentication, you're changing logging, and it takes a while. A lot of times, those functionalities are put in when the product was conceptualized. You probably do not even have the people who wrote that code at the company anymore. So there are major issues there. If you bake it in, yes, there are the upfront costs, but potentially it is easier for product maintenance. It goes back to the previous slide. I bet you if you overlay, you know, at what point of time certification requirements are considered in this timeline, it will have a similar cost ratio. That the later you decide to do certifications, the more difficult it becomes. Next certification for pain points. How, you know, everyone's moving to Agile. Agile is great. It gets products out faster. And guess what? Certification is anything but Agile. It's waterfall all the way. So how do you align timelines of your development timelines, your business timelines with certification requirements? Always a pain point. Maintenance. Previous talk was exactly about that. You have to make changes. How do you do certificate maintenance? So you certified one and you think, oh, now I can sit back, relax, let the sales come in. But sure, you have to maintain it. Requirements change, vulnerabilities come in, bugs come in, and pretty much as soon as the product is released. So you cannot certify a product every release. And finally, the alphabet soup of standards. As I mentioned previously, you have more and more requirements to adhere to. Sometimes they are in conflict. I was talking to a smart card vendor recently, and that person has to do a FIPS 140-2 and FIPS 201 requirements. FIPS 201 requires biometrics, and he enabled biometrics, but to meet FIPS 140-2 requirements of 1 in a million password guessing, he cannot meet it with biometrics. It will take a long time and a lot of tries for a user to scan his fingerprints to be able to meet the 1 in a million requirement. So now we have 2 standards by the same agency, NIST, with seemingly conflicting requirements. Now this is just within one agency. Now we extrapolate it across country, across the globe. It's a nightmare.
So yeah, our solution, you know, is
always
it may be not that superheroes are coming to solve the problem, but we think we've got a way that you can that'll help you think about this. So when I think of the pieces of a product security program, these are the major headings. And we're going to go through and just and talk about each of these in a little bit more detail, but this just gives you an idea. You know, secure development lifecycle is, you know, kind of the most important foundational thing that we have here. Education, tools, there's even a sales process in quotes because I don't mean actual, you know, salespeople. PCERT, community, consulting, certifications. These are all the pieces that go into, you know, a successful product security program. And so we've got a few different goals. I would say that the one in the top left and the one in the top right are probably the most important from my perspective as more of a generalist. But I think this certifications one, you know, also plays up, you know, pretty high. We want to fix bugs faster. You know, that's ultimately a goal of what we're trying to do. Security evangelization. We want people in the community or in the company to be engaged with security. We don't want them to say, oh, security, that's the security department's problem. And we still hear that, even in 2016. That still happens in some organizations. And so we want everybody to think, hey, I'm part of the security solution that's solving the problem. Trustworthy products. You know, that was a big thing when I was still working at Cisco. That was a big mandate that we had, is we want products that are trustworthy. But I think it comes out as a good general goal as well, you know, because you don't really want trusted products because that has some kind of baggage with it. But trustworthy means, you know, they deserve the trust.
And when you make in certifications, you move away from the checkbox mentality of meeting certifications to something that is a value addition to your product. It helps you do a value addition, so you roll in a story around a larger product security story, which is certifications forms one part of it. It helps getting budgets easier, and it results in a better product and a more efficient process.
Yeah, so when we're talking about product security programs, you know, there's an issue of scale, right, whether you're a big company or a small company. And some people would always, you know, when I made this type of a recommendation, they say, well, you know, when I used to work for Cisco, I'd say, well, you work for a company of 100,000 people, so you can throw 50 people at this problem. And my guidance to them was, you know, you can even start a product security program with one person. Now, granted, that one person's going to have to wear a lot of hats, right? They're going to have to be in charge of the life cycle and the response process, and how do we get certifications, you know, boiled into this equation as well. But you can't say this is only for big companies. You know, this is something that can be done for big companies and little companies, both. Okay, so this is kind of a very high-level secure development lifecycle picture. And, you know, as you kind of look around there, you might think, well, that looks like a general product lifecycle. You know, there's really nothing security specific, but there are, you know, specific security things that fit into each of those phases. So we have specific security requirements that we want to add in the requirements phase. Those things that are going to help us from a FIPS perspective or from a common criteria perspective. Those all need to be weighed in as requirements. In the design phase, it comes down to, you know, one of the big things there is what we call threat modeling. How can we look at a design and try and figure out any potential vulnerabilities that may cause us problems in the future so that we can fix them, like we said earlier in the process. Development becomes about secure coding guidance. You know, how do we teach and train our developers to not use printf functions in C anymore that are, you know, ripe with buffer overflow style conditions. And then on the testing perspective, you know, what are we doing from a vulnerability testing perspective, penetration testing perspective? How do we bake that into the process so it happens for everybody? And then when we get to release, it becomes about, you know, the product security incident response function. What do we do when a researcher out there sends an email to the company and says, hey, I found this really interesting problem with your piece of software here. PCERT is the process, product security incident response team, where you go through and deal with that type of an issue in a you know, standard way so that you know how are you going to get the notice out to the world versus just panicking and trying to deal with something like that from a chaotic perspective. But I really do believe that secure development lifecycle is the foundation of the product security program, because all the other things I'm going to talk about, if you don't have the secure development lifecycle, it makes it very difficult to really accomplish anything, because, you know, engineers will look at you and say, well, where does it say that I have to do that? You know, where does it say I have to do code review? And if you don't have, if it's not part of your life cycle already, and you have to answer that with, well, it's just a best practice that we think you should do. then a lot of times people are going to just put their hands up and say, no, thank you, I'm not going to do anything that, you know, is not mandatory. But so Secure Development Lifecycle allows you to set up that process that then can be blessed from a corporate level where everybody says, okay, or executive management says, this is what we're doing for all of our products. And just one other note to think about with this, you know, you have one secure development lifecycle, but every product and all the releases within those products is at a different point on that circle right there. It's not just like there's one SDL process for this product and everything that's happening with that product is at the requirements phase or the design phase, right? Each of those releases is in a different place, whether, you know, maybe the 2.0 is in requirements phase while 1.2 is in test and about to go out, you know. So the idea is that there are multiple instantiations of this as we go through the life cycle. So the first, and this, I'm going to go through a couple of different pieces of the product security program that I think are the most important, but this list is not ordered by importance, so I didn't have this as like the top thing or, you know, whatever. But consulting. So consulting, this is the idea where maybe you're just a single person that is the product security team, or you have a whole group of people, but this is the area where you're going out and actually working with different teams within your organization, different engineering teams or testing teams, to educate them about the SDL. A lot of what happens from a consulting perspective is truly education, because we don't really want to go out and do the work for people. So I used to be in charge of the threat modeling element at Cisco, and I always tried to teach people to threat model instead of threat modeling for people. Because if I threat modeled for people, they would just come back 2 months later and say, hey, we got another release. When are you available to spend 4 hours with us drawing the pictures and figuring out where the problems were? But if I would teach them how to threat model and that light bulb would go on for them where they would just truly get, they'd make the connection with, wow, there are real vulnerabilities in our product that we got to deal with, then they would be able to go ahead and do that on their own. So, there's you know, consulting on, you know, you can do consulting from a FIPS 140 perspective. You know, you can have people in your product security team who, like the model we had at Cisco, Cisco had the global certification team, which was actually a dedicated group of around, I don't know, last time I heard, 20, 25 people, just focused on helping product teams do certification work. And so they were part of that consulting wing of our product security program because they were out there, you know, teaching people what they needed to do for FIPS and even helping them create documentation or, you know, do the other pieces that they had to do. There's a number of tools that come into this that the product security program enables and really provides value. You may have a requirements management tool to track these different security requirements that are being done against different different releases. You can have testing tools. I'll talk some more about those in a little while. But there is definitely a need for some type of tools. And to do that, and the reason I mention that is that, you know, you have to have some resources that are dedicated to making those tools be successful. Executive account management. This is going out and meeting with different product teams that exist within your organization and selling them the idea of security. And, it's not sales in the traditional idea. I mean, they're not writing you a check at the end of the day. But you do have to help them understand, what am I going to get? You know, what is the return on investment for us actually doing these security actions and things that you want us to do? And I find that this is a function that can exist within the product security program. You need some people that are out there having those conversations and encouraging teams to, you know, to understand what is the ROI on this. Because product managers don't speak security. They don't speak vulnerabilities. They don't speak, you know, bugs. They speak money. And if you say, if you go ahead and do this, it's actually going to save you money and resource from a development perspective. It's going to make our product more attractive to the customers that you're trying to sell to. That's the type of thing that they understand. PCERT is just the process that you go through to deal with vulnerabilities. This is just kind of a blown-up idea of the different things that can go into that. But it's important to have that as part of your product security program because, you know, you don't want vulnerabilities to slide under and not be tracked and not be dealt with. So that's all I'll say about that. And then security community. You know, it is some of the biggest success I've had in building a program like this at Cisco came down to having a solid group of people that were behind me in doing that. And We had a group called our security advocates, and these were people, they didn't work for me, but they were people that were passionate about security, that were developers or testers, and they would actually, so that I didn't have to go out to each of the product teams within Cisco, they would actually go out and they would be that first line of defense that would be there advocating for security. And sometimes they would need help. They would call and say, you know, can you help us? But the community side of this is very important to get people engaged and, you know, get that idea that security is everyone's problem.
And then certifications. That's about overlaying certifications over SDL. So it just helps make your business case better. You're trying to make the business case for certifications or for SDL. You're encompassing it, so you can tie in with ROI. If you do SDL, your product has X percentage of the requirements already baked in, and then you only have to worry about the remaining pieces. And if your product is certified, this is what you get out of it. So it just makes your ROI that much more simpler to do.
Okay, and then the last piece that I see of the product security program is the idea of education. And this is kind of shows you just an example of what we created at Cisco. But education is huge, because a lot of times people in the average engineering organization, they just don't have a really high understanding of security in general. And, you know, we have to teach them those basic lessons. And there's things that can be done that we found in just teaching engineers what is an exploit and what is a vulnerability was a huge step when we were going to them with a particular problem. You know, instead of having to explain the basics of security, if they had that core knowledge, that would really, you know, benefit them in, you know, as we were trying to work with them. So yeah, I mean, education's huge. We approached it, you know, the way I approach it is to have multiple levels of education and let people see that there's a path, and I think that's a powerful way to teach people things versus just trying to send somebody to a secure coding class. Because what I find with secure coding classes is they're great, they have really good contents, but 6 months later, if you go ask that engineer what they know about secure coding or what they learned in the class, they're going to say, I don't really remember. Because if you don't put those types of things into use, it just doesn't resonate with you. So keeping a program where they continue on a journey through the world of learning about different security things is just a way to stay engaged.
Now, overlaying certifications with SDL. So Chris talked about what is SDL, what are some of the important aspects of SDL. Now, tying it all together, and how is it that you can overlay certifications with SDL and gain efficiencies out of it? So first, building a team, right? So there's always that question, do you want to build a team? Or do you want to buy the expertise? And depending on the size of the company, depending on the goals, it really depends. This morning I was having a conversation where, you know, the person was trying to figure out where he's right now one of three people in the company of many thousands that does certifications, and he's trying to figure out what does he want to do. Does he want, should he build out a team the way he saw some of the companies do? Cisco, as Chris mentioned, had, you know, 20-25 people doing FIPCC, DoD, UCAPL certifications, or does it make sense to just, you know, use outside consultants to do it? More often than not, the answer will be a hybrid approach. You want to have an internal team, a robust team, so that you can do two things. You keep the expertise and knowledge in-house so that you're not reinventing the wheel every time. And also so that you can call out something when something is egregiously wrong, in terms of when your consultant or lab says to do something and it's egregiously wrong, then you have someone as a checkpoint, as a balance out that, hey, maybe you do not need to go to repaint that product green. The product, the requirement does not say it has to be painted green, it just says it has to be painted a dark color. So that's why you want to have a hybrid solution.
And that speaks to the consulting side as well, right? I mean, if you're just working with consultants that you're paying to do your validation efforts, they're not going to be in your building all the time. You know, it's good to have some, I like that hybrid approach, I like that idea, have somebody at least from your team that has that knowledge and responsibility, because you don't want to necessarily write a check every time. It'd be good to have somebody who can jump in, you know, in certain situations.
Then you want to create a security baseline. So a lot of the requirements, especially number of requirements in FIPS, but a lot of the requirements in the PP conformant approach to common criteria, a lot of the requirements just make good sense. Having password strengths, having logging requirements, having secure transfer of logs. you want to make those requirements as part of a product security baseline, and then have product teams adhere to this product security baseline. So as part of conceptualizing the product, getting a commitment to develop the product and developing to the products, you have the baseline as part of the PRD, such that when the product is now ready to be certified, it probably meets 50 to 60% of the requirements right out of the gate, and then you only have to worry about the delta there. So it just makes life so much more easier that way.
Yeah, and so, from a security design perspective, this is where our requirements meet our plan. You know, how can we take those requirements and then write them into a software spec or a functional spec that, you know, is actually gonna meet the requirements? And, you know, I think it's important that, you know, the meet or exceed idea for requirements in our design. You know, meeting, in the average engineering organization, they're always going to be trying to meet the requirements, right, but not exceed. But this comes down to the fact that certifications can actually provide, you know, a lot of additional value if we don't just treat them as a compliance, you know, checkbox kind of activity, things that we have to do. You know, if we really use them as a sales tool, but also use them as a way to make products better, you know, you just get two kind of double things from that perspective. Threat modeling, I introduced this idea already, and this is just a systematic process to think about, to get engineers to think about, how could my product be attacked? What are the interfaces that could be used? And, you know, FIPS, and I don't think Common Criteria has any requirement for threat modeling.
No, but you could use it, and if you're doing an EL-based approach.
Yeah, you could bring it in, though. Because it's systematic. It's a way, it's teaching people to think about how their features or products are going to be attacked. And, you know, you can do it literally on a napkin. You know, we're using just data flow, the basics of data flow diagramming, you know, processes and entities and, you know, data flows and data stores, the really basic things that we, you know, if you did a CS degree or something, you might have done in an introductory class. But it's taking that picture and then being able to teach somebody how to look at it and pinpoint, well, there's an interface there, there's an HTTP interface there, and somebody could send an attack through that particular interface. So that's the idea with threat modeling. And I think it does bolster certifications. I think it's something that hopefully will be included in the future. Then we talk about implementation. So implementation is code. So, you know, we have to have secure coding guidance. We have to provide guidelines to our developers. We also have to have processes for secure code review. And those things tend to, you know, from a FIPS perspective, even from a Common Criteria perspective at higher levels, those tend to be disconnected, right? We're not taking advantage of an existing process as much as the FIPS code review is kind of like a special FIPS code review thing. Maybe you can include some of those things, you know, within your standard code review process. Maybe some of the things that FIPS is looking for are things that should be called out there. But so that's the idea of code review. And, you know, some people are talking about, you know, this idea of pair programming may be the way to deal with this in the future, where you have two developers that are always working together at the same time. I'm not sure if that is going to work any better, if that's going to provide the right resources, but that's something that you can consider as part of your SDL and your product security program, is how you deal with the implementation issues. So another thing to think about kind of from an implementation perspective is, you know, you have two different types of testing tools, static application testing and dynamic application. Static application security testing tools are where we're actually running a program against a set of code, you know, and that program knows how to find buffer overflows and knows how to find SQL injections and knows how to find, you know, the major vulnerability types. But then on the dynamic side, we actually have to have a compiled program. We have to have some type of, you know, we have to have something actually running. And the DAF tools are things like Nessus and, you know, Metasploit, and, you know, there's a number of different web kind of scanners. But both of these things are important from a product security program, because we can't just rely on checking the code. And each of these things just, they find different kinds of problems between the two of them.
Then test integration and automation, right? Why keep doing the same thing over and over again? You can automate a lot of the conformance testing, automate it, put it into your nightly builds, Put it into the testing that is done for nightly builds, and then you know you're maintaining compliance on the product. So anything changes, you already are running tests on it. So by the time the lab comes in and does a review, you actually have all of the test logs ready to show the lab, and it just makes the process go faster. It also helps in certificate maintenance, one of the pain points I mentioned, right? So if you have automated and built-in conformance testing within your standard QA test, as you develop the product, it is continuously being checked, and when you're ready to take your product back in for certification, you already have that level of confidence that yes, it meets these requirements already, and it quickens your process. It should reduce your cost as well, right? So you can go to the lab and say, hey, we already have automated these. We have looked at these before. Here are the test logs. You do not have to reinvent the wheel here. Let's figure out how recertifications can be made cheaper and faster. So I would strongly recommend automating as much as you can. I know at Acumen we try to do as much automation as we can, but we are limited because we have to test different types of products. But for your product, as you automate your QA, you should be automating the certification testing as well.
Are these all the robots that do the automation at Acumen up here?
Yeah, we are still at maybe two. We have to build it out. just a quick story. Chris found this one. It apparently is all the robots in pop culture that has ever been there.
Okay, so then when we're talking about release, this is the set of steps where, you know, our product security incident response team is playing in here. And so, you know, certifications require flaw remediation and you know, checking of bugs and things. And what I'd love to see people do is actually include that idea of flaw remediation right into their product security incident response process. So instead of having these things be two separate, you know, activities, teach the people that are in charge of tracking all the vulnerabilities for your product, teach them enough about the certification process so that they can probably perform the flaw remediation, at least the tracking of all those types of issues and those bugs. They can probably do that for you just because they're already looking at all the problems along the way. So we have top six tips that we'll share with you here about collaboration between SDL and certification. So the first one's teamwork. Okay, I think it's ensuring that certifications are part of that product security program are very important, because I think there's a lot of good things that can happen. And I think the SDL and the product security program can bring in a lot of good things for certifications, but I think the flip side is also true. Certifications provide a decent set of requirements. I mean, most product security programs use FIPS and common criteria as the baseline for their requirements anyway. You know, so that's a place where the connection is happening. So teamwork is very important for, and certification should definitely have a seat within your product security program and even within your SDL.
So I would say, I would also say teamwork outside of the company as well, right? With the consultants and even with your lab. If your lab or consultant is at cross purposes, you will always have a painful certification experience. Whereas if they understand your development process, understand the flow that you go through, understand what you are already doing internally, then and leverage that just makes it easier.
And then, so education. So there's a huge need that I always found when I was dealing with new product managers, and that was to make that business case for certifications for them, so that they would actually understand, you know, what is the return on investment for me as a product manager. And so I think, you know, education, actually teaching them that versus just trying to, you know, strong arm people into going into the certification process, I think that's a way that you can have more success.
And the education piece helps if you already say that, hey, you're already doing 80% of the stuff by meeting the product security baseline. It's just 20% that you have to do add on, as opposed to coming and saying, here's a whole new set of requirements that you'll have to meet in 6 months' time, and we should have started 6 months back. That's just not going to work. So if you build it into your process, educate them that this is how, if you follow SDL, you get a better, more trustworthy product, but also it helps you with certification, just makes it easier.
Yes, and then partnership. You know, if everybody that's part of the product security program knows what the common goal is, and they're all in on those goals, then I think that, you know, partnership, like you were just saying, goes bigger than just inside the company too. But everybody, you know, certification should be part of that team and should be able to take advantage of all the good things that are happening there. Harness the value of certifications, and this is my vote no on checkbox compliance, kind of a hot button issue, because I've just seen in my career so many different products that went through the motions to be certified just so they could be sold versus really taking advantage of the benefits and things that come out of the certification process. So, you want to add anything on that?
No, I think so. This, by far, to me, is one of the most important things, right? When you look at certification on its own, you're looking at it from the perspective of, okay, let's get that checkbox and get done with it. But if you roll it into a larger process, it becomes a natural thing to do, and it becomes more than a checkbox. Yes, part of it is a checkbox because you want to make that sale, but in the process, you're also making your product better.
Yeah, and customers these days, you know, it's hard to find a customer who doesn't have a concern about security, you know? I mean, try and find somebody that looks across the table when you say, hey, is security important to you? Try and find somebody that's going to say, nah, doesn't really matter to me, and, you know, not that important, my data.
So how do you sell that to execs?
From which perspective?
We want more than just a checkbox.
Well, I think that, you know, if your executives don't have that perspective right now, I think they need to spend more time in front of customers that are dealing with these types of security issues, because I really don't, I mean, with all the data breaches and all the things that have happened, you know, historically, people should have a very good perspective on what's going on in the world of security. Now, convincing them of the return on investment is going to be more difficult in the beginning, but that's why you're not going to create this whole thing that we're talking about here on day one and try, you're gonna pick small pieces and kind of add to it and pilot and build your way up.
So I have an interesting perspective I feel on that it becomes a natural offshoot of an SDL program where your certifications become more than a checkbox. So yes, an executive might say, okay, $1 million sale is on the line, let's just get it done with and be out of it. But if SDL and certifications is overlaid with SDL, it's part of your process already, then it by default becomes more than a checkbox. And on the ROI side, it's interesting in that ROI on a certification is easier to pull than an ROI on SDL. Because there's a direct tie-in with dollars and cents. So you can use certifications as a Trojan horse to get SDL in, and you have then ROI as well, and it becomes more than a checkbox. So I think it becomes all put together then ends up answering the question of the checkbox as well as ROI.
Yeah, and I've even seen some large telco customers now starting to make SDL a requirement. So I think that's coming. They'll mandate that you actually follow your own SDL, which seems like a strange thing that somebody should have to mandate to us, but, you know, it does happen. So I think SDL is going to be right up there with some of the certification requirements within the next year or two as far as what customers are saying. Contractually, you've shown me your SDL. Now I'm going to tell you contractually you must follow it for the products that I get from you. Okay. So custom versions of products to meet cert requirements. The reason this one I think is such a challenge is that, you know, engineers in general like to work on things that are meaningful and provide value to them. You know, engineers are not big fans, and I'm just speaking, you know, in general, not big fans of busy work and doing something that doesn't actually have a lot of meaning to them. So, you know, if you're creating certification product versions just for the purposes of getting on the list and putting it out there, I think you're doing your engineering team a disservice. You're probably going to have a hard time finding people to actually participate, or you're going to have to twist arms to say you're going to be working on the certification project of building that code, because if you have a product that is never meant to actually go and be used widespread. So the point of this is just, you know, certify the versions of your code that you're actually, you know, actually selling to customers and using.
And honestly, maintenance becomes a nightmare. Right? The different SKUs that you create and then maintaining them and keeping track of them, it just becomes a nightmare. Yes, for that initial time, it's great. You're not disrupting your normal product development cycle. You have created a special SKU for the U.S. federal government and you have done it. But now remember, you have to sell that product again and again. Any vulnerabilities that come out, you have to track vulnerabilities across multiple SKUs, it just becomes a nightmare. It sounds great in the near term, you could potentially charge more because now it's a different SKU, that means it's going to be, I can charge more, but in the long run, it does not work out.
And then, yes, treat your, so if you do have those internal certification folks, treat them well, you know, give them pizza and other goodies. I don't know, I guess we couldn't.
It's not easy.
We couldn't put beer on the picture for whatever reason. I don't know, sponsors or something. But so yeah, so wrapping up kind of what we talked about here, you know, vulnerabilities are present. You know, the cert challenges that we have here are real. There's probably, we probably could have, if we had more time, we probably could have gone around the room and everybody could have shared different cert challenges they had that would have matched up with that list.
You're planning to do a safe space session next time around.
Yeah, everybody can talk. Yeah, but I think truly that this idea of the product security program, it does really support the certification effort. And I think that the two really do fit together. And I think if you try to create them separately, I think that's, you're going to be spending too much time, you're going to be wasting time, wasting effort. I think they really do mesh together well. And then, you know, collaboration always results in a better, secure, and certified product. And what's our call to action coming out of here?
More than a checkbox. I think so. That is important. It's very tempting to treat it as a checkbox. Initially you do, but then it always becomes a fight to stay afloat. It becomes more difficult to justify certifications. It becomes more difficult to get the budget that you need. It irritates the hell out of product teams. So if you can build in value, do that. That will make life easier.
Yeah. All right. So I think we probably have some time for questions. I'm thinking.
You can share the microphone.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So this is the only session where the speaker will bring you the microphone. Oh yeah. I'm working today. It's my part of my job.
So my question is from my narrow point of view about the SDL. Is that something that companies would, like, if there was a standardization of the SDL itself? Is that something that would be welcome, or is it better that the companies do their own thing? You know, as part of the certification, that is, you know, the standard requires an SDL of a specific, you know, with specific requirements.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely a great question. There is an ISO standard for SDL that Microsoft was very, Microsoft has always been the leader in the SDL space, and everybody, you know, is usually familiar with their tools. So they led this ISO standard through. To date, I'm only aware of one company that's actually been certified against it at this point, because this is a very, we're all doing the same basic things, but we're not identical.
Right.
And some companies are more mature in, you know, the testing phase from vulnerability testing, but maybe they're bad at secure coding guidance and code reviews. So I think just the fact that there's only been one company that's certified against it kind of answers that for us as an industry. But certainly I think in the future, as more companies become more, they get further down the road. I mean, some companies are just starting this now. You know, Microsoft started it 15 years ago with the Gates memo after they stopped everybody and made everybody work on security for 3 months. That's when the SDL was born. I think it was in 2004 maybe, or 2001 or so, I don't know. It's a long time ago. So other companies are actually catching up at this point, and I think we could see more of a standardization in the future.
Steve Lipner was instrumental in that, right?
Yeah, Steve Lipner is a name that was very prevalent at Microsoft in that role.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Everyone wants wine.
Yeah, everybody wants wine. Let's see if we can get you to the front of the wine line. All right.
Thank you.
Did that end up working?